To the third day of our Jacksonville sitting, and we're glad to have Judge Dubina back with us today, and Judge Hull will finish out the week tomorrow. You're familiar with our lighting system. When the yellow light goes on, that means that your time is drawing to a close, so try to finish up your remarks. If we take you beyond the red light, then don't worry, just keep talking to us, and we'll keep going as long as we need to. And with that, we're ready to begin with our first case, number 18-11218, United States versus Donato Amaya Rivas. Ms. Bailey. Thank
you. May it please the court. The district court convicted Mr. Amaya Rivas based on a guilty plea that was not knowingly and intelligently entered because the district court never advised him of any of the rights he had as an accused under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments of the Constitution. The plea colloquy here was a total or almost total failure to satisfy the core concern that Mr. Amaya Rivas understand the consequences of his guilty plea. The record lacks evidence that he otherwise knew of these rights.
Let me ask you this. When I first looked at this case, it almost jumped off the page that we needed to reverse it because it reminded me of United States versus Hernandez, which I wrote the opinion in about 20 years ago. But when I went back and reread Hernandez, there seems to be a real difference in what happened in that case and what happened in this case. And let me be a little more specific with you. What we said in Hernandez was during the plea colloquy, Hernandez said to the court, quote, he really didn't know about this plea because he didn't know what his rights were. And so we wrote in our opinion after that response that the district court should have ensured that the defendant was aware of his rights because there was nothing, absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that the defendant understood his rights. When I went back and read the plea colloquy here, there were actually two with the magistrate judge. Even though the magistrate judge didn't specifically follow the script that, quite frankly, all federal district judges and magistrate judges should follow so we don't have this kind of problem, he didn't follow that script precisely, but it seems to me when I look at the questions and I look at the answers, Hernandez did, in fact, understand his rights. What do you say about that? Tell me what in this record would indicate Hernandez did not understand his rights. Coupled with the fact this is about the fourth time he's been in court, he's one of these revolving door immigration cases that we see. So can you answer that? Tell us what in the record shows that he didn't understand his rights, just like Hernandez clearly didn't understand his rights in that case.
Yes, Your Honor. I have a couple of responses. First of all, I don't think the burden is on Mr. Amaya Rivas to show that he affirmatively did not understand his rights. I think that the burden is on the court to ensure a knowing and voluntary plea.
The burden is on him, though, to show that but for the alleged error, he would not have pleaded guilty anyway. And I can't find anything in the record to show that.
Your Honor, and I respectfully disagree that is actually the test, that but for, because the errors here go to the heart of the plea. Looking at Hernandez Fair compared to Amaya Rivas, in both of those cases, the district court completely failed to advise him of three rights in particular: the right to a trial by jury, the right to be protected from compelled self-incrimination, and the right to confront and cross-examine the adverse witnesses at trial.
I agree with you on that.
And those three rights were also mentioned as a failure in Boykin, as going to why the plea was involuntarily made. And in both Hernandez Ferrer, Boykin, and Amaya Rivas, we don't have any advisement of these rights. Yes, it's true that in Hernandez-Frere, the defendant did express some confusion, and he said, I don't know about my rights. That was in response to a question about whether he was being coerced or not. And the district court has an obligation to ensure that the plea is knowingly and voluntarily made. You cannot waive your right to your constitutional rights to a jury trial unless you know what those rights are. A waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a known right, and if you don't know what the rights are, then you can't waive it. So,
in this case, you also have, I don't know what the ultimate answer is, but you also have the failure to secure an admission to a couple of elements of the offense, even though one of them seems to be almost undisputable, right? Yeah. The fact that he was an alien.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, we do have that as well, which goes to the nature and circumstance of the offense, which this court has articulated is the second core concern that this court looks at in determining whether a plea is knowingly and voluntarily made and determining whether or not it affects the substantial rights on plain error. That is another example of why this plea colloquy was a total failure to satisfy these core concerns.
But the Supreme Court has been very clear that a Rule 11 violation is not the equivalent of a structural error. It's been very clear about that. Why on a non-silent record should we read into this as structural error rather than just a Rule 11 error that can be remedied?
Your Honor, first of all, we don't necessarily have to call this structural error because I do think that it fits into the court's core concerns test as a way of establishing that it affects his substantial rights. You can call it structural error. When the Supreme Court has said that the Rule 11 violations were not structural error, those did not go to the heart of the knowing and voluntariness of the guilty plea. I think that it was whether a plea agreement was violated, whether a promise was breached with respect to a plea agreement, and that did not go to the very heart of the constitutional rights that you're waiving and giving up by pleading guilty. The way I think we look at it is we're on plain error. We can show that there was error. These rights were not advised. It's plain under Boykin. It's plain under Hernandez-Frere. And we have to show an effect on substantial rights. Clearly, starting with Boykin, the court said that plea was plain error because there was no advisement of the substantial rights. And this court always applied the core concerns test as a way to evaluate the substantial rights and a way to evaluate whether the plea was knowing and voluntarily to begin with. This doesn't happen very often. Most of the time, as the court said, there's a bench book and judges follow the script and they don't omit, or they omit maybe one element, there's a slip-up, and I know that the court's been forgiving of certain slip-ups, but this is not what we have here. We have a complete and abject failure to address the core rights that the defendant was giving up by pleading guilty.
How do you assess his determination to go forward or not go forward under a plain error standard, given what happened here?
You mean
go forward with a plea or not go forward with a plea in terms of the last plain error prong?
With all due respect, I think that Dominguez-Benitez is very clear that when it's a Rule 11 violation, then the defendant has to show a reasonable probability that he would not have pled guilty. But that footnote in Dominguez-Benitez says that there is an exception. There's a category of cases that doesn't fall within that test. And that the example that they give is Boykin. And they say that when there's no evidence that the defendant knew of the rights he was putatively waiving, that you cannot save it by a showing that he would have pled guilty anyway.
This case did not have a plea agreement, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And that also makes a difference, because if it was just maybe that the court failed to tell him in open court about his rights, but those rights were contained in a plea agreement, that might be a different story. But here, we don't have a plea agreement. The notice of maximum penalties does not advise him of these crucial rights to trial, jury trial, confrontation of witnesses, against self-incrimination. And we really do have a silent record, just like they had a silent record in Boykin and Hernandez-Frere. I don't think that the defendant needs to show that he was confused by this. How is he going to show that he's confused when he doesn't even know? No one's ever told him what his rights are.
Should we assume that no one ever told him what his rights were in any of his previous criminal trials?
Your Honor, the court in Hernandez-Frere was also clear about that. We cannot import to him or infer that he knew from one of his other... Well, first of all, let me back up for a minute. This is his first time in federal court. His other convictions were in California state court, and frankly, I don't know what the process is in California state court. He's been deported before, but that doesn't mean he was ever in a courtroom when he was deported before, and the rights that he needed to be advised of here are crucial. They're attendant to a criminal trial. They're not attendant to deportation. I see my time is up. Do you want me to finish?
Let me ask you one last question. During the plea colloquy, I think the first plea colloquy with the magistrate judge, didn't he tell the magistrate judge that he had discussed the consequences of pleading guilty with his lawyer? What weight, if any, should we give that?
Your Honor, I don't think you can give any weight to that, because I think that we cannot transfer the court's responsibility to ensure a knowing and voluntary plea to either just the defendant or his prior record, his prior criminal history, his prior experience. You can also transfer and put it all on the defense attorney, because we don't know what they discussed. I believe it's in Jones or James, this court did not impute that knowledge, it wasn't saved. You couldn't attribute it to the defense attorney. So I would not put any emphasis on that, because the court has an obligation. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much. You saved your time for rebuttal. Ms. Karinas?
Good morning. May it please the court, Jennifer Karinas for the United States. Since the court's been talking about Hernandez-Frere, I want to talk about that a bit. In the plea colloquies, there are four really important differences between Hernandez-Frere and what happened here. In Hernandez-Frere, there's nothing in the plea colloquy in which the court confirmed that the defendant had discussed whether or not he should plead guilty and the consequences of that with his lawyer. And in contrast here, as the court's already pointed out, the court did confirm he'd had an adequate opportunity to talk to counsel about whether he should enter a guilty plea and the consequences of doing so.
What do consequences mean to you in that context? That you're likely to be sentenced to a certain number of months, or that you're going to have a federal felony on your record, or that you're going to be waiving your right to a jury trial, and what that waiver consists of, or all of those things, or some of those things? How do we figure that out?
Your Honor, we can't figure that out here. Obviously, we concede the court did not list all of the individual rights. And this is not any different than a lot of cases where there are Rule 11 violations charged. You have to look at the whole record to determine whether or not the plea is knowing and voluntary. And again, this case, Hernandez-Frere is very clear that it's one of its primary concerns was, in addition to the failure of the court to list those rights, there was a statement, I don't know about this plea because I don't know what my rights are. And even when he was asked in Hernandez-Frere, are you pleading guilty because you're guilty or for some other reason, he said, well, I have to eat and I'm homeless in Mexico. There were plenty of evidence in the record, and we look at the whole record, that showed that there were some serious concerns about whether he really understood what was going on, and the court should have inquired further. So in that limited...
One of the points made by your colleague makes a little bit of sense to me, which is, how can you show confusion on a topic when you're not told about the topic?
And that's a fair point, and again, the court did not list those various rights here, and that's the record. But going from there, the question is, if we have plain error as to the Rule 11 colloquy, what happens next? And under every case in this circuit, in the Supreme Court, what happens next, it is the defendant's burden to show prejudice. It's the defendant's burden to show that the outcome would have been different, that it affect the error that happened.
Not on an involuntary plea.
Not in an involuntary plea, that's true.
Here you don't just have the three Rule 11 violations, you also have the failure to secure an admission to two elements of the offense.
Your Honor, that under this court's prior precedent in Camacho and Presengu, They both have said in a less complex case like this, it can be sufficient even to just read the indictment and ask, do you have any questions? And here the court did a lot more.
No, but you combine that with the Rule 11 violations and it becomes a little more serious. If you had just the Rule 11 violations, I understand. If you had only the failure to secure an admission on two elements of the offense, I understand. But now you have five problems in the context of a guilty plea. Let me ask you this, and it doesn't go to the legal standard that we have to apply and that we will apply. But as an institutional matter, what's wrong with just sending this back and saying this is unacceptable? Do it right.
Well, as an institutional matter, the Supreme Court in Davila in 2013 reversed this court for a different type of Rule 11 violation because it said Rule 11H means no automatic vacatures. It is still the plaintiff's, is still the defendant's burden to show that he has been prejudiced. This is not like...
No, I know.
Sorry.
That's why I said my question didn't go to the legal standard we have to apply.
Right.
My question was more institutional.
I understand.
Why not send this back and say, do it right? This is unacceptable. It cannot happen.
And I don't mean to suggest that Rule 11 is not important. Obviously, Rule 11 is the procedure that the court is supposed to follow to make sure a plea is knowing and voluntary. So there is some tension there. But again, sending back a case where there's been a Rule 11 violation and not requiring the defendant to show prejudice creates an automatic vacature rule that is not consistent with either this court or the Supreme Court's precedent. That's the institutional problem, is saying you're going to have a defendant who can sit quietly during his plea colloquy, not object, get a sentence he doesn't like, and then come into court and say, there was a mistake in my Rule 11 plea colloquy, I want another bite at the apple. Unfortunately, there are irregularities in a lot of these Rule 11 plea colloquies. Some are more serious than others, but that's why the Supreme
Court...
There
shouldn't be many.
There shouldn't be. And it's...
Does the U.S. Attorney's Office have a checklist that it uses to make sure that all of the relevant Rule 11 factors have been discussed at a plea colloquy?
Your Honor, I have not myself conducted a Rule 11, a guilty plea hearing. I would hope that there is something that the USAs are to follow.
Long, long time ago, at least, U.S. Attorney's Offices made sure that AUSAs who were going in to be present for a plea colloquy had a checklist sort of that ran along the lines of the federal judge's district court bench book. And every time the judge went through a Rule 11 factor, it was checked off, checked off, checked off. And then if something serious was missing, the attorney would gently try to tell the judge, could you just go over, you know, this other thing one more time? I think I might have missed it, or something like that. That might not be a bad idea.
I agree, Your Honor. I agree. It's incumbent upon the AUSA and the judge to make sure that a plea colloquy covers all of the important factors to make sure that the plea is knowing and voluntary. But when that doesn't happen, that doesn't mean that we have a rule that the plea is automatically vacated and the defendant gets to go back and try again. And that's, Supreme Court in Vaughn emphasized that and said, this is a harsh rule. This is a difficult standard to make. But that's on purpose because we want to give the defendant an incentive to raise his hand and object, or his lawyer, because...
How is this case different than Boykin?
Boykin, the record is utterly silent. So there is nothing in the record that the court could look to see, does this person just overall seem to understand his rights? So it's very different than this case. This is not a silent record. Saying that the court neglected to say something or list some factors doesn't mean that's a silent record in the same manner as a Boykin was. Or the other three cases that were cited in Amaya Reeves's briefs, where the court had failed to advise the defendant of the nature of the charges, utterly failed. Not like in this case where the court read the elements, asked if he had read the factual basis and agreed with it. In those cases, there was nothing in the record to assure the court that the defendant understood the nature of the charges against him and when he was pleading guilty. So in those cases, the record was silent, as the court said. Here, this is not a silent record like Boykin. So the court doesn't have to wonder and worry, this person, did he seem to understand overall? And this isn't like Hernandez-Frere, where there is an express statement by the defendant. And this court seems to recognize in Moriarty, for example, in Monroe, that there is a difference between an automatic vacature rule for a Rule 11 violation in Hernandez-Frere. None of the subsequent cases by this court have read Hernandez-Frere so narrowly. They have pointed out that Hernandez-Frere had not only a failure to list all of the rights that go along with a trial that would be waived, but also included these statements showing that the defendant was confused. And in fact, I think Moriarty is a really good example, because in Moriarty, it's almost the same here. The district court touched on the fact that he was waiving the rights that go along with the jury trial. He did not list most of them. He listed one or two of them, but didn't list several of the important ones. And Moriarty said, there's plain error. We recognize that, but now what do we do with that? You still have to show prejudice. And Moriarty required the defendant to show that it affected his substantial rights, that it would have made a difference. And here, Amaya Rivas doesn't even make the effort to say, I was prejudiced by this. There would have been a different outcome. Had the judge not only read all of the elements, asked me if I had understood the factual basis and objected, and not only reread two of the elements, had the court read those other two elements, I would not have admitted them. I would not have pled guilty. Or had the court read all of those rights that I was giving up associated with trial, I would not have pled guilty. And that is the defendant's burden.
So you think that, I mean, first, his overall plea was knowing and voluntary, or at least he hasn't met his standard under plain error to show otherwise.
Your Honor, I do, because, again, this is in contrast to Hernandez-Frere. There is, I think, enough here to distinguish it from that, where there was at least they touched on the third core concern, didn't read all of the rights associated with it, admittedly. But it's, again, I think it's distinguishable from that. So we would first say there was error. We don't think it was plain error. But even if it was, it is still the defendant's burden to show that he was prejudiced, and he has not even attempted to do that here. And there's not a special category of sort of quasi-structural errors where there's a Rule 11 violation that is so bad that it becomes a structural error. That's a very different, special, limited class of cases with names like Gideon, where it's such an overall failure to have a fair trial that the court has to reverse it. And those cases, even it's without regard to whether or not the defendant's prejudiced, because it's such a serious violation of one's right to a fair trial. So this is not anywhere on the order of a structural error, but it's also important to know that even in structural errors, the Supreme Court in Puckett in 2009 and again repeated in Marcus said, we're reserving the question of whether even a structural error automatically satisfies prejudice in a plain error review. So even as to that kind of level of an error, it's not automatic. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Davila, this court should not adopt a rule where a Rule 11 violation can lead to an automatic vacature, because it runs contrary to Davila, it runs contrary to Rule 11H. If there are no further questions.
Just a comment. I want to second what Judge Jordan said to you. We were both trial judges. What happened in this case should never happen, ever. District judges should go, or magistrate judges, right by the bench book, and you avoid this kind of problem. But the U.S. attorney has some responsibility, too. As Judge Jordan pointed out, if you see a district judge, leave something out. So, Your Honor, I would appreciate it if you would also advise the defendant of this right or that right or whatever. And then you avoid cases like this.
I agree, Your Honor, and your point is well taken. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Initially, Your Honors, I'd like to clear up one matter about the record. There was only one plea hearing in this case, and it was on December 19th, 2017. Previously, Mr. Amaya Rivas, on December 1st, 2017, and this is at Doc 12 in the record, he waived his personal appearance at arraignment and entered a plea of not guilty at arraignment. So we don't even have an arraignment transcript to go back and look for. And he made his initial appearance. He was arrested on the complaint October 31st of 2017. He waived his personal appearance at arraignment on December 1st, and then he went in and pled guilty on December 19th. So even if we look at other parts of the record, there's no indication that he was advised of these rights. The core concern, the third core concern that this court talks about is the consequences. And yes, there are subcategories, if you will, under there. The consequences of pleading guilty include things like your maximum penalties, that you're going to, that you'll be sentenced under the guidelines, that the court has to consider the guidelines, that you have minimum mandatory penalties, but then they also have the rights that you're giving up by pleading guilty. And those are that's the fundamental heart. So if a court can touch on the core concerns and still advise of the maximum penalties, but if the court doesn't do the heart of the guilty plea, a waiver of a right to trial has to be knowingly intentionally made. And there's two parts to a guilty plea. You're both admitting your factual guilt as to the elements and the crime and the conduct, but you're also waiving your constitutional rights to trial. And that's the part that we just cannot excuse here. We cannot ignore that.
To be able to prevail, given the standard you have to overcome, you have to be able to convince us that his plea was not knowing and voluntary, right? Because if it's just a Rule 11 violation, then you run up against a plain error standard and the requirement that you essentially show a reasonable probability that but for the mistakes, he would not have entered a guilty plea.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's correct. But I do think that we show that there is a due process violation and that this is an involuntary plea. Looking at Moriarty, in this court in Moriarty, the failures... There's a footnote in Moriarty where the court says that in Moriarty, that court touched on the failure to advise of a, or excuse me, that court touched on the right to a jury trial. It touched on the right against self, to protect yourself from self-incrimination. It touched on the right to confront witnesses, okay? What it didn't do was some of the other things like right to forfeiture, I believe it was, and the right to prosecute him for perjury if for a statement he made under oath. Those were more true Rule 11 violations that didn't go to the heart of the voluntariness of the plea. And in Moriarty, the court said those were Rule 11 violations. He couldn't show an effect on his substantial rights. They drop a footnote and they say that's exactly why the Moriarty was different from Hernandez-Frere, because he did touch on those core rights, the right to jury trial. And that's what we have here. That's what we had in Hernandez-Frere. That's what they had in Boykin. And that's where the Supreme Court is leaving open in Dominguez-Benitez a little exception for this particular case where you have an involuntary plea. I don't think this court needs to change its core concerns. I think if you have an involuntary plea, you have to show an effect on substantial rights, but it's necessarily shown by the fact that you have an involuntary plea, because now he's incarcerated, he's imprisoned, he's deprived of his liberty, all because of a plea that was invalid from the beginning.
That happens in every case. That's why you have to win on knowing involuntary, because that's the way you get around the plain error standard. And you use footnote 10 in that Supreme Court case to eliminate that burden, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It necessarily, and that's why the court has said it's automatic. It necessarily violates plain. It necessarily is plain error. It violates the core concerns. If the court has no further questions. See, my time is almost up.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.